Welcome to Influential She, the podcast about accelerating the influence of women in the world.
You will find us to be a fresh voice in an old conversation.
And here we are, your amazing co-hosts, Deb Soholt
and Mel Schopp.
Well, hey, welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Influential She. So glad that you would take a little bit of time out of your day to tune in. And we just love everybody that's giving us comments and feedback about Influential She and what it's starting to mean to them. And Melody and I are just super excited about opening up this grand conversation in the world. I'm one of your co-hosts, Deb Soholt.
And I'm Mel Schopp. And today we are going to explore a little bit with our guest, the high leverage practice of voice. I love the tagline, Deb, that we use with this one about be the voice, not the echo. A lot of times I think it's easy to fall into the whole habit of allowing everybody else to determine how we should be thinking and talking and doing whatever. But I know that as we talk with our guest today, and you and I experience this a lot within, you know, and whether it was in the political realm or even in our personal lives, that we had to make sure that our voices were heard in not just the traditional way, but also in a way that was going to impact the work that we were doing.
Exactly, Mel. And, you know, when you talk about using your voice and a high leverage practice of voice, you know, we've spent a lot of time thinking about how do you develop individual power through your voice? And I think this is the tricky one and one that we've had to really work hard on developing because it's all about using your voice to elicit thinking in others. Now, I think that's just a key distinction that we've spent a lot of time talking about because in the current way things are in just kind of polar opposites of opinion and politics and culture and conversations and relationships, it just seems like there is so much, are we going to be a yes or no or this or that? And that it is just, it has to be one or the other. Whereas what we're talking about with this practice is how do you have other people want to think about what you said, not just about how loud you said it or the words that you said, but that it would generate a new kind of conversation. And we have just like an amazing guest, right, Melody? That's just, I mean, introduce her.
Yeah.
We got to get talking to her.
That's right. So I'm really excited today to introduce Angela Jerebeck. I think I've always called you Angie. Angela, so welcome to the show today.
Angie, thank you.
Oh, you're so welcome. This has been a long time coming because this is a short term friendship that I've had with you. But one of those things that you just go, oh my gosh, I love hanging out with this woman for a lot of different reasons. And one of them is that you have just on your own made this impact across the education space. But it really has been in the way that you have elicited your words and your voice in walking into a world that sometimes was not one in which, you know, somebody in your position might have done that. So, Angie, you know, you're the founder of BARR, B-A-R-R, the BARR Center, and you went off in a little bit of an untraditional path as a school counselor. Can you tell us just a little bit about that and how your voice had to be heard above all the other noise?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. I also really want to kind of focus in terms of voice because much of my work has really been about hearing others' voices. So I was a school counselor and pretty much what I was doing was trying to make sure I was hearing the student's voice. And that when I mean the student's voice, really hearing their whole experience so I can be able to really figure out how to support them. And I knew if the other adults also were hearing their voice, they would want to do the same. Because, you know, you're working with all these adults who've been so committed to helping young people. And a bit of the story in terms of the work of BARR is I was a high school counselor out of First Ring suburb right outside of Minneapolis. And after 5 years of half the students failing the class and finding out the honors kids were misusing Ritalin, I was not feeling successful. Because I am like all of these students, you know, this is such a critical time for them to be successful in terms of high school and they are failing classes. And so I went to the principal at the time and he said, you know what? It's not you. It's not our school. Like half the kids fail a ninth grade course and, you know, these risky behaviors show up. So if you have a better way of doing things, you know, I'm really open to it. And so kind of left it at that. And actually I had two young kids at the time, and I was home in the summer, and I looked over and I had my 6-month-old in my lap, and my 4-year-old daughter was sitting in a kiddie pool, and she grabbed a handful of crayons and started eating the crayons. And I was incredibly discouraged because I thought we were past a crayon eating stage. And I proceeded to call my grandmother, which is what you always do when you're upset. And she immediately kind of launched into how Haley actually was so bright, and she had just picked her up from Sunday school, and the Sunday school teacher had said how she was such a helper for this other girl who was scared. And then I remembered my sister took her to the playground and how brave she had been. But I had this realization all of a sudden that all these other adults that were with my kids were making me a better parent, and that I was better able to kind of help her develop into the person that she could become to be based on these other voices. And I realized schools needed the same thing, that we needed to have a mechanism that all these adults could be sharing their experience with each other. And we really could also be really kind of hearing what the students' voices are, so we're able to kind of move forward. So it's interesting that you kind of bring in voice. I certainly will talk about my voice, but my entire work has always been really honing in to hear others' voices.
So you took it there from there because it had been easy, honestly. Mm-hmm. You know, you've always told the real story is that you actually went to the principal to say, hey, I'm done. You know, mm-hmm. I'm not doing this. That's what you were going to do. And he said, okay, do something about this. And you did something about it. Mm-hmm. But it took some courage for you to really push yourself in there and create something that was different. But I think about this all the time because I know how schools work. You had to use your voice to convince your colleagues, all the people you're working mm-hmm. with, is like, we're going to do something different. How were you mm-hmm. perceived, and how was that? Here's this person who's going to tell us now what to do. And how have how did you make that happen? And 20 years later, have this amazing, success that you're where you're at today.
I think that the ability to use my voice, I still will go back to the fact that I was reflecting their voice back to them. Because I would go back to them and say, you've told me that no one wants to teach ninth grade because the students are failing. And you've told me you have no ability to kind of, do this work. You also, I know how gifted you are as an educator. So the fact that it's not working is not a reflection of you. It's a reflection of the system. So let's give this new system that I've come up with a try. So I think that's part of the reason that they were willing to, as a kind of a colleague, coworker, be able to hear my voice, because I was like, I'm hearing you, and I'm hearing you say this is broken. So let's try something different. And then when things, our failure rate cut in half in the first year. We subsequently had a full decade of not only our students not only passing classes more, but we had an exponential increase in students taking AP and honors classes, and then had a waiting list for our school when we often had students, we weren't able to kind of fill the seats before. So after that and the success came, then people were in particular more willing to hear voice.
So Angie, tell us a little bit more just about, you both know about BAR so much, Melody and you. Mm-hmm. And so for those that really don't even know what BAR is or what you mm-hmm. launched and mm-hmm. and created and had happened, tell us just a little bit more about that.
Well, I'm actually going to go a bit to the punchline because it's so exciting. We're actually, going to be working with over 150,000 students as of now, which is a pretty remarkable thing.
Wow.
But I'll go back to kind of my general beliefs. My general beliefs are students are very capable of learning if we actually can see who they are. And my other belief is educators are incredibly talented if we provide a system that we can realize their talent in. So the BAR model is coaching and training for the school that enables that to happen. So we break up these silos, we break up these kind of traditional systems, and it's been highly tested. We've had 20 years of research, and we've worked in over 180 schools and tested it most rigorous way we can with randomized control trials and lots of evaluators. And that's been an interesting adventure in terms of being a school counselor from Minnesota and having developed things, and then having many people come up to say, I don't think this is going to, hold in terms of the evaluation, and having it hold time and time again. And I think during that space in particular, I love your kind of be the voice, not the echo. Forever, I was continuing to be the echo. So I was letting the evaluators do the talking and kind of continuing to cheerlead these incredible educators as I still do, but then also realize someone's going to have to actually spearhead this message. And someone's going to have to be the one that is going to be saying, this is possible, nation, to actually you know, transform our schools, and the educators love it and the students really are thriving. So it's important to cheerlead, but it took me about 18 years, the past 22, to actually shift gears to say, I can cheerlead as well as go into an audience and say, I'm speaking on behalf of all of these educators. I have a message too.
You know, there are two things that have always resonated with me that's so foundational to BAR, just taking your point a little bit further, Deb, is that it, you know, it's built on two pillars. It's built on relationships and data. Mm-hmm. And we always know how critically mm-hmm. important that you're building those relationships. And Angie, that's what you're a master at, whether you are thinking about how you've led the organization, but that's also what is so foundational within schools. Can you just share a little bit about the two pieces? And I want to talk more about you in particular, but I think the relationships and data are just, it shouldn't be unique in school, but it really is, you know?
It really is. And so I go back to my vantage point when I was a high school counselor. I kept going, there are two guardrails that should be guiding everything. One is data. The fact that the school counselor is often the only person who has any access to the fact that even though Melody's failing math, she's really good at English. So the math teacher may think Melody's just lazy, and the English teacher may know there's no issue at all with math. So everything's log jammed with the school counselor or administration. So I'm like, first of all, we've got to have transparency into data so we can actually see how the student is doing. And the other piece of data is qualitative data. Any adult who works in schools knows, sees, feels things all the time. You walk through the cafeteria, you can tell if something's brewing. You can tell if there's a breakout happening. You can tell if, you know, early love is in the air during prom. But like those qualitative data pieces have to be, adults have to be encouraged to capture them and share them in a strength-based way. So that actually is going to, you know, make a system work. But the other big piece is relationships. And yes, I think it's well established that students and staff need to have a healthy relationship. Rarely is there necessarily an overt structure or coaching for that to happen. But then the other piece that is often ignored is you have to also focus on student-to-student relationships and staff-to-staff relationships. Because in particular, you are going to get some data that the staff is going to see that you're like, I had no idea that everybody failed science. And everyone looks at the science department and then people feel defensive and angry. And if you don't have a staff-to-staff relationship, you're not going to actually be able to problem solve that without people, you know, kind of going back to their departments and saying, well, we have rigor. The English department going, well, apparently I don't. But, you know, how you foster staff-to-staff relationships is a lot of the work that we do, which I think is, you know, just a really critical piece. But that's the essence of BAR. And once again, it sounds obvious, but it's actually very antithetical to the legacy ways of school. So it does have this new openness that everybody sees what's happening. And so everybody gets to have a way to solve it, which I think is why our schools are so successful.
You know, Angie, when I hear you talking, I just feel like I hear your educator voice coming out, but also all of the things that you're saying about, you know, students are capable of learning. Well, we're all capable of learning. I mean, mm-hmm. I just start to think about this larger platform of being educated and understanding and having data drive the relationships. Mm-hmm. And just feels like in many respects, we move away from that mm-hmm. and that there is so much credibility in it. But talk a little bit about, I can't imagine everybody was always that excited about the facts. You know, that you have all of these, this mountain of information, and you would think mm-hmm. that when you present the facts, just mm-hmm. like in the broader arena, you present the facts, you just think, well, then that's self-evident. We have objective facts with a lot of, you know, to back it up. Mm-hmm. But then the human experience comes right in beside it. So talk a little bit about some of the struggles you've had in raising that voice of truth.
Mm-hmm. That has been some of my biggest learnings. Is I was, and still am, but was really, really dedicated into the research of BAR. So once again, we spent 22 years just doing the research because I thought somehow if it continued to be shown to be effective, that that would then lead adoption where it's like, it's clearly working. And that disconnect of that somebody, you know, how does that become personal and back to the human experience? And is that data my data? And kind of what does that mean? And regardless of where you went, you know, it became this, you know, well, that was a neighbor, you know, over, or that's not, you know, the kind of, that's not me. So I think it's that idea of gaining voice also required that then I took the voice because I was deferential in terms of evaluators and sending things over, and they're continuing to tout it, but they also speak in an academic lens versus I kept going, this is what humans need to have to interact. I mean, somehow we've moved away from the general understanding that we have to be able to see each other in multi-dimensions and work with each other in multiple dimensions. And then kind of back to these guardrails, be in relationships. And, you know, once again, have some sort of data around it. I will say our bar is now working K-12, and I was just looking at a lesson and I loved it. And it was, it was a lesson about a children looking at clouds and seeing different things. And once again, having this debate of, I see this, I see this, I see this, I see this. And then just recognizing it doesn't matter that we can both see different things and how we can still be friends and how we can discuss the things that we see. But like teaching those lessons at age 5 feels really critical right now. Also feels critical at age 50 that we're like, hey, we can have a dialogue and see different things and we can still be in relationship. Now, that being said, it's really important that there's some data that I can point out. This is why I see the cloud this way. And this is why I see the cloud this way versus just moving that forward. But that point, that conversation, that message, I do feel is so much broader than just in our schools.
Angie, talk a little bit about when you were trying to find your own voice. So you mm-hmm. said, you know, we've got 20 years of data. And, you know, when we see it on the summary end, if you will, it just all sounds so slick, right? You've got all this data and you have, but talk about how you, because you said you were sending the data on to others and then you mm-hmm. assumed that maybe they would pick it up and go. Mm-hmm. But somewhere along the way, you shifted to say, I've got to insert my voice and start seeing mm-hmm. some of this through. And so talk about some of the obstacles or the hurdles or mm-hmm. what was difficult about that.
I think it's kind of a number of things. And it really was very gender interesting. So I will just call it like it is. You know, I was... And I kept going, I'm just a school counselor from Minnesota. I'm just a school counselor from Minnesota, as well as I think teachers often are always just, you know, and I absolutely am about service. But then you would kind of put this beautiful package together in a present, and then you would hand it to these people with, you know, multiple PhDs. And yes, they are brilliant, but then they would be taking it the angle that they were interested in, you know, and sharing things in a way that you're like, oh, it's not really what's, you know, kind of the important part that I'm seeing or the school is seeing. So that was one of the impetuses for like, I need to kind of grab this forward, as well as it became a thing to study versus a place to act, you know, where I think that the evaluation is really necessary. So, you know, it's effective. I'm a huge believer and we cannot waste educators' times by having them do things that doesn't have evidence behind that it's going to work. But in the same respect, this is a time for action. So how do we inspire? How do we, I mean, actually this, the overall topic of voice, I think one of the most critical things that BAR does is give every educator a voice, just like it gives a student a voice, because the educators now have the information in front of them. They have a voice to be able to talk to one another. They're not just following a legacy system and kind of taking things, but it gives them the ability to say, here's what I see with Deb. Here's what I'm going to try. You know, this is, it is empowering and makes them feel like they're able to carry their message forward and kind of in first in their other educators, but then in the community. But I think that entire, you know, broader conversation is how do you also empower voice in a way that's respectful? And how do I, you know, be a voice that people can follow, recognizing that you're kind of blazing the way for others to have their voices be lifted up?
You kind of glossed over it. So I'm going to take you back a little bit. You talked a little bit about being gender specific. Share some of those mm-hmm. situations where you felt that you probably were not being regarded in the same light than what you would have mm-hmm. hoped initially. I mean, I've just observed you over the last few years and, you know, just amazing how you've really taken on, you are, you know, you've taken on this important role of being the voice for BAR. But take me back a little bit, because I do think, you know, we've talked a little bit about those issues where you felt that there was sort of this gender barrier in having your voice heard.
So one of the ones that was most pointed is, so the success of BAR really has been largely funded by federal research grants. So been, you know, we received $35 million in federal research grants, you know, over the past, you know, decade. And so when we had received a $20 million grant to research, went out to DC. I'm in this big long line at Starbucks And there's a lot of chatter. And clearly, once again, a school counselor from Minnesota has just received this. And a lot of people are talking about it because we're up against kind of all the ivory towered institutions, happen to be male people around. And they were talking, they're like, it would be one thing if I got beat by Johns Hopkins or Harvard. I got beat by some school counselor in Minnesota. Can you believe it? And I'm standing right there. So I'm like, I want to be like, imagine that.
You're right.
The school counselor.
Snap.
Exactly. So like that was the most explicit, but you know, it has been this very interesting, you know, space in terms of, especially in leadership, you know, it's largely males. I will name also my own temperament is, you know, defer, you know, and support. You know, how do I support? How do I support? How do I support? Which is why I go back to some point, you need to be the voice and not the echo, where I'm like, because the rest of the schools and students can't echo if I don't speak. So how do I encourage and provide a mechanism for others to bring their voice forward?
You know, Melody and I have talked about this idea, well, not only just the idea, we've actually experienced it like many times where, and very respectfully to our male colleagues, because we have in no way, shape, or form trying to diminish talent. We're just saying we've seen and experienced these roles where we would be in the room and one of our female colleagues would say something, great idea, like amazing, like early in the game. And then the conversation would, it was like, oh, well, that's, you know, and then it would emerge again, maybe couched slightly different, but the same idea from a male counterpart to then be like, oh my gosh, it's like an amazing idea. Mm-hmm. And so it's, we've seen that over and over again. Is that something that you experienced as well within your space? You talk about it in the Starbucks, like, oh my gosh, we're just like humiliated that this counselor actually beat us.
Uh-huh.
But it's just saying it is a reality that we've experienced. Have you seen that in your work as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I as much as I both see it because I think it's socially normed, I did want to also take my responsibility in it because I think many times if you don't speak, somebody else will. So I think this idea of kind of waiting for the data to speak for itself or continuing to be, you know, very deferential, that provides a void. And then others are speaking. And then you're like, okay, well, that was my idea. Like that was like a really big idea that is now, you know, being said by someone else. And even if later, you know, they come back to say, hey, I know that was your idea. The person who spoke it is the one who then kind of owns the idea or is associated with the idea. So absolutely. But as much as I similarly don't want to blame male counterparts, I feel like, you know, many of the meetings, you know, especially at certain levels are largely male, and recognizing if I don't speak, somebody else is going to. And this is also, and for a while I went back and forth going, well, I don't care who says the idea because I just want it to get out there. And that was true to a point, but then it also became, but why shouldn't it be if I'm the one who came up with the idea? And the other thing is, and by the way, you've twisted it a little bit. So I'm like, how do I get this kind of back to at least the idea origination that how it came from, and others can move it, but at least get the kind of the original concept to kind of its initial status.
Another thing I just thought about this morning. I was just thinking about you, Andy, about how oftentimes we are put into certain spaces as females from all different ways in which we're perceived as far as how we're actually looked at and perceived. I do remember one time, it wasn't so long ago, you were getting up to speak at one of your conferences and you were told by one of the males that you needed to get up there and try to make yourself look bigger. Okay, so you're a small person, but it was like somehow he was perceiving that unless you could make your persona be bigger, that was the way to get your voice heard. And it just struck me so, I don't know if it struck me wrong, but it just like, seriously, this woman is powerful and you're telling her she needs to make herself look bigger in that sort of way.
Yes.
I know that sounds really odd, but it stuck with me for so long because I thought, I wanted to tell him no, because her words are powerful. It isn't how she looks.
And yes. I love that you say that too, because it really was like 10 minutes before I'm walking on stage and they, you know, pulled me aside and just said, you have a really important message. And you know, you're not physically very large, which by the way, I'm aware of. And they're like, so you need to make sure that you physically look bigger. And I'm thinking like, do I walk on stage and like wave my arms? Like what am I supposed to be doing? Like, how is this, you know, like, how is this a more credible message if I'm like, you know, stand on a stool? Yeah. But that's an interesting piece, Melody. I said, yeah, I'd forgotten that, but it really was this moment of, what? Now I don't know what I do with this feedback.
Yeah, okay. I remember it really well because that would not have been shared with a male. It was almost like you had to somehow have this other piece with you to make yourself heard. And yeah, I think those are things that we need to really be sharing.
Right. I don't know, a lot of males would be told, please get bigger on stage.
So Angie, you took a big idea. Mm-hmm. And you started to move it forward. And I mean, you're talking in large numbers of like $35 million in federal grants in the last 10 years. And that's just significant work and how you've put together 20 years of data. What kind of roadblocks in your own mind did you have to start to make your way through to develop the confidence to keep moving forward?
I think there was a couple things. And it's so interesting you say that. I never doubted the model. Which is a really odd statement to say, but I just knew it would always work because I think part of it is like from working within the system and having these belief systems, I'm like, kids are smart. Educators chose this profession. This will work. Like I just like knew that that was going to work. I think how do you logistically navigate things? And, you know, both not being trained in business, which once again, I mean, this is a business, you know, how do you message? How do you communicate? How do you kind of, you know, learn all those things at the same time you are representing? I think I have this, you know, tremendous responsibility to make sure that I'm, you know, kind of representing this work that educators are doing. So things I did was continuing to kind of surround myself in particular by other really strong, powerful people, especially women, to be like, how are you managing these spaces? And I think that's been absolutely critical to have a team of others to be able to problem solve and move forward with.
Yeah. And as I've seen just even over the last few years, how you've continued to, you know, it's always like, Aunt, you need to stop being the doer. You need to be the one that's out there. And it was always so hard because you were trying to do all the work. And so I think as we figure out how to navigate that and how you've continued to be the face and the voice, that, you know, that's going to be even more critical as BAR continues to expand and as it continues to grow. If you could look back and you could say, you know, what was the one thing I just wish so badly I'd known or wished I'd done or wish I could have said? You have a daughter. We both have daughters. We talk a lot about our kids. Mm-hmm. What is the one thing that you would really want to be able to share with everybody else about, you know, finding that way in which you can use your voice in a way that's going to make an impact and moving forward?
I think it is the confidence and the confidence to do things that haven't been done before and confidence to do things that you haven't been like officially trained in. So like, you know, there's so much of work of innovation and leading means you're doing things that others haven't done. And so, especially in the beginning, I always was like looking to say, okay, how do you do this? And I kept trying to find people to coach, you know, how do you do this? And then you're like, so how do you start a national nonprofit and like, you know, change the landscape of education? And like, everyone's like looking around and I'm like, well, no, I need to like know how to do it versus trusting myself that I have, you know, the ability to figure these things out and then surrounding myself by others versus looking to others. I think that's like the big thing. I actually had just got a message yesterday from my daughter saying, hey, there's this opportunity. I'm not sure I'm really qualified. Do you think I should apply? I'm like, absolutely. But before I'd be like, no, wait until you can check every single box very cleanly and then let the person decide if it's a close enough fit or not. Where before I was always like, don't move till I feel like everything is completely checked. And then if it's all checked, then take that next step versus going, I feel like I've got a general idea. I'm surrounded by smart people. I'm going to continue to get feedback, but I got to move forward rather than just keep waiting. Maybe I wouldn't have waited 20 years with the research. Maybe a decade would have been enough.
Maybe Deborah and I wouldn't have waited 40 years or whatever we did.
Exactly. Yeah, maybe we wouldn't have started a company like at this stage of our lives. But right? You know, we were like, well, we don't know much about this. We don't know where we can head. But we're going to do it anyway. We're just going to throw our shoulders back. And if you can just stay one step ahead of you know, just the situation that you're in.
Yes.
I think you can problem solve so much because so many times we don't think we can draw this skill set from that skill set and kind of cobble it together to then have a voice to move forward, mm-hmm. that we want it to be more tidy. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I just don't think that's how life rolls. It's, mm-hmm. it's juicier and more unpredictable than that, mm-hmm. you know? And yeah. then couple that with being in some kind of service industry where you're dealing a lot with unpredictable human beings, which is where the interest is. Mm-hmm. And that's why I love what you've done, Angie, about thinking about everybody needs to learn and somehow this has to be integrated. Mm-hmm. So we're not just in a silo of math to mm-hmm. science to English to elementary to middle school to mm-hmm. high school. You know, mm-hmm. there are so many preconceived notions about how one of these human beings shows up in those mm-hmm. environments. And I think we see that with the women that we talk to from all over the world, that I'm showing up, but I don't know if I'm inherently ready. And I just think you're trying to say to the women of the world, just go. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
And surround yourself and get your questions answered. Because if you're smart enough to kind of get here to the idea, mm-hmm. you're smart enough to really start to figure out how to move forward.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I think it's that's an exciting way of thinking more entrepreneurial wherever you are, whether it's a community volunteer in a professional role or trying to climb up the ladder. You know, one question I wanted to ask you, Angie, is like, where did the roots of you come from? Like, where did you begin this journey? I mean, we got to the point where you're like a counselor mm-hmm. in a high school, but what kind of propelled you to this place?
So I was a music performance major as an undergrad. And ooh. I also was pre-med for a number of years because I love science. So I had a very difficult time picking a major. I had awesome parents who said, I don't care what it is, but you're done in 4 years. And so then you became, well, I have a lot of music credits, so maybe that's it. And lo and behold, got my teaching degree K-12. But it turns out I was not Mr. Holland's opus, and I was student teaching. And I'm like, this was a mistake. This was not what my dream was. And so I was teaching at a local college, and they said, you can get your master's degree for, you know, a fraction of the cost if you keep teaching here. So I'm like, what program do you have? And they're like, psychology. I'm like, I love psychology. So it was a pretty non-linear path. And then I finished that, you know, psychology degree, got my school counseling license and started school counseling. The reason I kind of bring up that, you know, that background is I'm very creative, you know, but I really love the sciences. So I've always been drawn to data and research and that type of experience in terms of kind of science and math, like in terms of my aptitude tests, I'm a science and math person, but I love creativity. And I think that that was the piece too. So when I'm after 5 years of working in the school system, I'm going, the system is just not working. And it, you know, it feels like we can, you know, clearly do better for both our adults as well as the kids. So in terms of kind of where did I come from? I feel like that combination of the innovation and the creativity, but so glued to, let's actually see what's gonna have some stickiness and work here.
Well, I just love that you brought up your inherent background and kind of what makes you tick, Angie, because that comes out in how you're using your voice, mm-hmm. that you have this creativity to be innovative and imagine a future that can be completely different, mm-hmm. but then you want to back it up. So you've got the qualitative, the human mm-hmm. experience, along with the quantitative, the hard data. And mm-hmm. wow, that's a powerful voice.
Oh,
that's a powerful
you.
Voice.
Thank you.
And I also know that you were surrounded by some pretty amazing, strong women in your life. I think your mother was mm-hmm. a strong force and so forth. So yeah. It's always interesting when we think back about who are those people who really gave us the, I would say, you know, the innate ability to be able to be out there and be creative and do what we needed to do. So, well, Angie, this has just been great. It's always so fun to talk to you, and you just always have so much energy, and I wish everybody could see your big smile, because I know that we just talked about it before we started. It's like, this is where we get it from, and it comes out in the words that you say. And so just thanks a lot, Angie. And it means a ton that you would take the time to be with us today. It means a lot.
Oh, I so appreciate this. Thank you so much.
Yeah. So, you know, to our listeners, there is just always this idea that we always want to make sure that we're leaving our listeners with something. I think today, and when you listen to Angie, she solidifies the fact that when we talk about trying to be really influential, that we need to raise our words and not just our voices. And that tends to be kind of the temperament right now across society, is that a lot of times we think if we're louder than somebody, then maybe we're going to get ourselves heard. But if we really raise our words and make our words meaningful and impactful, that's when we're going to get heard, and that's when it's going to resonate, and that's when it's going to last. So thanks again to everybody who's out there and listening to us and following us and being part of it. And we want to leave you with just this question today. Have you ever really thought about how you use your voice and how you can help your voice to help you to be influential? Thanks again, and we hope you tune again to another episode of Influential Share.
Thanks for tuning in. If you enjoyed our podcast, we'd be so jazzed if you rate us on whatever app you use to find us. And hey, be sure to tell all your friends about Influential She.
And please visit us at InfluentialShe.com and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn. And you know what? If you come up with a new one, please let us know. In the meantime, remember, stay influential.
This podcast is a proud member of the Teach Better Podcast Network. Better today, better tomorrow, and the podcast to get you there. Explore more podcasts at teachbetter.com/podcasts, and we'll see you at the next episode.